This is Director Jared Maples of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and I want to welcome you to Season 2 of Intelligence Unclassified. This season, we are refocusing our episodes to better reflect our office's three core mission areas: counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. We'll be pulling both local and national experts in these three fields, all in an effort to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and offer you a unique perspective on the current trends and issues facing the Garden State. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at NJOHSP. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov.
Welcome to Intelligence Unclassified. My name is Eric Tzarczyk, the Director of Policy and Planning for the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. It's my pleasure to introduce our guest this afternoon, former Governor of Vermont and member of the FirstNet Board, Governor James Douglas. Sir, welcome to New Jersey. Thank you for taking the trip down from Vermont to join us today.
It's great to be here, Eric. Thanks for your hospitality, for the tour of your headquarters and facility, and the opportunity to see some of the equipment that you've deployed.
To properly introduce our guest and give our audience some important background, Governor Douglas served as the 80th governor of Vermont from 2003 to 2011. Before that, he served in a number of positions in the state over three decades. He served as a member of the Vermont House of Representatives, as the Secretary of State, and as the state treasurer. While governor, he was chair of the National Governors Association and the president of the Council of State Governments. Governor Douglas also served as chair of the New England Governors Conference and the Coalition of Northeastern Governors. In February 2010, President Obama appointed him to be the co-chair of the Council of Governors. He is now an executive in residence at Middlebury College, where he graduated with a Bachelor of Arts degree. Governor Douglas serves on the boards of several local companies and is on the Governor's Advisory Council of the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington. He is also the town moderator for Middlebury, a post he has held for the last 25 years. Governor, this is quite a list of accomplishments and duties. So where do you find time to do the necessary deeds for FirstNet?
Well, you're very kind, Eric. I think it really means that I'm old. But I've had a tremendous opportunity to serve in different roles at the state and local government and at the federal level as well, as you indicated. When I retired from office in 2011, I remained in touch with my friends at the National Governors Association, and they thought after the FirstNet law passed the Congress in 2012 that it would be good to have a gubernatorial perspective on the board. Their initial thought was to recruit a sitting governor, but they realized that that would be a time commitment that likely wouldn't be feasible for someone who was still in office. So they looked to the ranks of the emeriti. And I was honored to be asked by the Secretary of Commerce to serve on the FirstNet board, and it's been a tremendous privilege for the past 3 years.
Well, I can tell you from the state's perspective, it's appreciated that a state and local elected leader provides that input into FirstNet's board. There are times, as we know, where some initiatives, especially from the federal level, can get caught up in the federal bureaucracy and the way things are done. So we're appreciative to have a former elected leader from the states to give the input into FirstNet and its board of directors as needed. For members of our audience who may not be as familiar with FirstNet, could you give a little bit of a background to where this initiative came from and in addition to your involvement and where it's going?
Well, FirstNet, or the First Responder Network Authority, as it's formally known, is the last unfulfilled recommendation of the 9/11 Commission. That was formed after the tragedies of September 11th and chaired by a former governor of New Jersey, Tom Kane. Governor Kane and his colleagues offered a number of recommendations in terms of improving the capacity of the American people and its governments to respond to crises of that sort. And everything has been implemented except the nationwide public safety broadband network. It took a while. It was 2012 when the Congress finally enacted the law to create the authority. And here we are 5 years after that, when we're just at the point where we're ready to send the plans out to the governors and to launch the network itself. So it's critical, I think, as many of our listeners understand, to have communications that are reliable, are a priority for public safety, are high quality, are along what we call the fast lane of the highway in terms of telecommunications, and provide the infrastructure to allow our first responders to transmit data and videos and other kinds of information over a reliable network. I think we can get there. I think we're going to get there. It's been a little longer process than perhaps many in the public safety community would have liked.
It's funny, you know, people are surprised to hear, and I'm glad you touched on it, that it was an important finding of the 9/11 Commission report. And I think over the last couple of years, as momentum has increased to get towards completion of the network, the plans out to the states, and reach that operational level where first responders and potential secondary users can start to see the benefits of what some folks recognized all along after the 9/11 Commission report. Can you talk a little bit about, over that time, what the role of FirstNet Board has been as you've been seated on it, and where the FirstNet Board is directing kind of the authority to go as we reach this critical point in network development?
Well, let me back up a little to the couple of years before I was appointed to the board. It was a very different environment then. The first board members were appointed in 2012 and had no staff whatsoever. They were volunteers, people from different walks of life around the country, given this tremendous responsibility without much in the way of resources to get it done. They worked very hard during those first couple of years to retain some qualified staff, but it was still a pretty small operation by 2014 when I joined the board. Now we have a very substantial staff, mostly in suburban Washington, D.C. We have a technical operations and laboratory facility in Boulder, Colorado, and we have a number of regional directors around the United States who interact with the states on a regular basis. The board is concerned about keeping this process moving along. Although I served in state government, I have to tell you, Eric, the processes of procurement in the federal government are far more onerous. And I understand how important that is, because we're talking about a very substantial $40-plus billion operation. We had a number of applicants or proposals from vendors and had to take that process very seriously. But it's at the point now where public safety officials around the country are itching to get going. They've heard so much about FirstNet. They've been watching this develop. In many cases, they were advocates for the legislation itself in 2012. And they want to get this going, and so do we.
You know, it's funny you bring up the challenges of federal procurement, challenges of statewide procurement. And historically, in New Jersey, we're proud to be one of the early builders through the Broadband Technologies Opportunities Program, through NTIA at the U.S. Department of Commerce, and a very strong partnership with FirstNet itself. For quite some time, it's been what I would call a public-to-public relationship, where we could commiserate and share the challenges among federal and state procurement. And now, recently, we've brought in a private entity into that bilateral, which is now a trilateral relationship, with the awarding of the contract to AT&T. Can you talk a little bit about what the role of AT&T will be as a partner for FirstNet and ultimately as a partner for the states, and how you see that moving forward?
Let me first congratulate New Jersey on being one of the early builder states. You received, as you indicated, one of the so-called BTOP grants from the Commerce Department about 7 years ago now, and it's been very successful from everything I see. You've got a tremendous deployment of different types of equipment in key parts of New Jersey. It's been working well, and the proof of that, I think, is that other states are reaching out to you asking for advice on how to design and implement their own system. So that's a real credit to you, to everybody at the Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, and I want to thank you so much for being a trailblazer to get this infrastructure underway. AT&T is our private sector partner. We envisioned this, and I think the Congress did as well, as a public-private partnership. Congress made available some funds from spectrum auction proceeds over the last few years, and that is going to prime the pump, but the major investment is going to come from the private sector. We went through a very exhaustive, competitive process to receive proposals from a number of different companies and consortiums of companies, and decided that based on their experience, the breadth of their network, the commitment they're going to make, that AT&T is the best proven technology partner to build out the system. They cover now about 99% of the national population with their services. And they're going to make available to first responders some tremendous resources and services very quickly as soon as states make their decisions to get underway. So I think this is the right approach. Part of the enthusiasm for this at the federal level is the fact that it will build out infrastructure projects that have been talked about a great deal in Washington these days. We estimate that about 10,000 jobs will be created nationwide as a result of building out this network. So there's a real economic value as well as the public safety component that is principal.
It's interesting you bring up both the economic value and the operational value, the partnership with the states, and I appreciate your compliments on the early builder. That is a proud project that was started before my tenure, and the appreciation and kudos definitely goes to folks that preceded me and the team that we have here. And quite frankly, as part of that effort, it goes across the state as well. Everyone from the New Jersey State Police to local police departments to EMS councils to local fire departments have all really come together in an effort to make this endeavor successful, not just in New Jersey, but as an early builder, to make it successful nationwide. And through that process, again, back to what you hit on a little bit about the procurement piece, some of those behind-the-scenes efforts had to be behind the scenes because of the way federal procurements were conducted and how the information had to be shared between the potential vendors and FirstNet as an authority itself. But can you talk a little bit about the work you are undertaking, FirstNet and the board, to educate the key decision makers, not just at the state level, but really to those communities of ultimate potential users of the system at the local levels?
We have some folks on the board and in our senior management team and on the staff at FirstNet who have law enforcement and other first response experience, but we want to make sure that we communicate with those who are on the ground today, who are out there providing services to the people of our country. And so we've had a process of consulting with local officials, state officials, of course, as well, but through organizations such as the Major Cities Police Chiefs Association, the National Sheriff's Association, the National Emergency Management Organization, to be sure that we get directly from them their thoughts on the specifics of the network and what would be most effective for them. So we've had a lot of meetings at the state level. We've had tribal meetings. We've had meetings with law enforcement and emergency response associations. And we feel that we've really reached out tremendously to everyone who has an interest in this process and have the information necessary to prepare and present state plans, which will be coming out soon, reflecting the wishes and needs of all the states.
And I think it's also worth noting that FirstNet itself, its regional employees, its outreach team, and the board deserves a lot of credit because of, as you mentioned, the continual outreach, the solicitation of data from the states, the localities, really that effort to gather the information about what's needed in that first responder community has been a large one, so much so we will joke in the community sometimes about it's a lot of meetings and a lot of discussions, but the data is taken in by FirstNet. And we saw where that data was used in the RFP and eventually the vendor award and what AT&T is going around now talking to states in anticipation of the FirstNet plan release. And so now we're at that stage, the plan released hopefully, but not to hold you to this, within the next few days. Can you explain a little bit the timeline, the next few days, the next few months, and the importance of the work that has to occur with the rollout of the state plans prior to first the governor's decision in each respective state to opt in or opt out, and then eventually for system adoption by the potential users.
Well, our plan is to present all of the state plans through a web portal to officials in every state and territory of the country. We have someone, as you know, who's known as the SPOC, the Single Point of Contact in New Jersey. We're honored to have you in that role, Eric, and that is the individual in every state and territory who is our principal contact as we develop the process and the details for the network. We are going to make that information available to SPOCs and to governor's offices very soon. State officials may get back to us with proposed refinements or questions to make sure that we've successfully addressed all the issues that we heard about during those many meetings to which you referred and addressing all the issues that have been raised there. After that, we're going to present to each governor, as the law requires, a plan, and then he or she will have to decide whether to opt in or opt out. Congress wanted to give governors a choice as to whether to invite FirstNet to deploy the so-called RAN, the radio access network, within the individual state, or to assume that responsibility at the state level. Now, it could happen faster. We discussed a few minutes ago how some law enforcement and emergency responders around the country are champing at the bit to get going and get this system underway. So it could happen as quickly as a state chooses to move forward. And I think governors and other state officials will see some real advantages to doing that. AT&T, as our experienced partner, is going to make available some tremendous opportunities to states that opt in quickly. They're going to provide quality of service and priority service along that fast lane on the superhighway on day one, as soon as a state decides to opt in. And the preemption should follow very closely after that. So I hope that states will decide to look at the advantages in making this decision and tremendous possibilities that are available if they decide to move quickly. If a state elects to opt out to go with a different vendor to develop its local network, well, we'll certainly do everything we can to make that successful as well. But the burden then goes to the state, and the governor and state officials will have to bear all of that responsibility. First of all, the financial burden of ensuring that the network is sustainable from a cost perspective. They'll have to assume operational responsibility. There are a number of standards in the FirstNet network that will have to be met at the local level and maintained over the 25-year life of this contract. And I think governors need to think about whether they want to assume that responsibility themselves or not. Within a very short time, the plan will be available on a preliminary basis to all the states to get back to us with any further thoughts.
Thank you, Governor. I think those details are important for two areas to touch on. One, I think it's important to note that the release of the state plans, the initial plan, it provides states and its localities the opportunity to provide comments back to FirstNet along the lines of what they expected to see and where they needed to go prior to the official clock starting for the governor's opt-in period. I also think it's important to point out that while there's a lot of details behind the plans, much of it isn't discretionary on FirstNet's part. You mentioned something that I think is very important. It was Congress's intention, and they wrote it into legislation, a lot of these points that really are driving FirstNet's efforts. Now that we've got the private partner in AT&T, and they are undertaking the statutory requirements of the network, and the FirstNet and its board are directing those steps that need to be undertaken. I think some of the folks are starting to see in the initial feedback areas where they have some more detailed questions. So I think one area that we've seen a lot of feedback on is what's the difference between what FirstNet envisions or how FirstNet envisions the network working and kind of the general commercial network as we're used to seeing in wireless deployments?
Well, this is going to be hardened. It's going to be priority access for public safety and other first responder officials. It's going to be preemptive so that during a time of heavy usage, the people who are engaged in emergency responses are going to be able to get on the network over those who are using it for other purposes. I know you've had large gatherings in or near New Jersey in the very recent past where it's been important that the network not be overwhelmed. And we've had those even in my small state of Vermont. We had a concert by the rock band Phish, and everybody was there, of course, with a cell phone taking photographs of the band on stage or themselves or each other and transmitting images and video to their friends. And that can overwhelm a communications network, especially in a rural area. So the advantage of FirstNet is that it's going to be high quality. It's going to be priority service. It will preempt others on the network and ensure that where time is of the essence, our first responders have access to the network to transmit the information they need. And there are so many examples that you've used here in New Jersey, Eric. An ambulance can be rushing toward a hospital with a critically injured or ill patient and send information about that patient ahead to the emergency department so that the physicians and other health professionals are ready to receive the patient and get right to work rather than waiting until the ambulance arrives. And that's what we're trying to do here, to make sure that communication is available, is immediate, is interoperable, and we can do an even better job of protecting the American people and ensuring their health and safety.
And as you articulate those benefits, of which I agree, I think there are many, and even previously you hit on some of the burdens. As we move down this path, and everyone says we're getting very close, as I said, you've touched a little bit on both. If there was one thing you would say to a state that was deciding to, or at least leaning towards opting in, is there one benefit you would highlight among the others? And I guess the same question on the other side. If there was one thing, especially as a former chief executive, that you would offer to a state considering opting out, what would that be?
Well, in terms of states that are thinking about opting in, I would reiterate the advantages that AT&T is offering on day one, which is a dedicated communications fast lane, priority access, quality of service, preemption, and a 24/7, 365 days per year help desk so that first responders can get answers to their questions around the clock. So I think the immediate advantages are tremendous, and it will happen a lot faster in a state that opts in because those long windows will be avoided. And I didn't mention what happens after those windows, which is a state that elects to opt out, needs to go to the Federal Communications Commission to get approval of its state plan. It has to go to an administration at the Department of Commerce to have it reviewed. And then it has to go to FirstNet to negotiate a spectrum lease within that jurisdiction. So there are lots of steps, and I don't think it's an exaggeration to say it may be a year or several years longer if a state elects to opt out. But I was thinking as you asked that question, what would I be looking for if I were still in office? What would I consider? How would I go about making this decision? I think the biggest question I would want to address is the risk. The governor has a lot on his or her plate, a lot of responsibilities, fiscal and infrastructure and programmatic. And here's a decision that is key because the governor is going to decide not only during his or her tenure, but for the next quarter century, whether the state is going to assume the responsibility of deploying its own local network. And I think some governors may be thinking, we've kind of seen this movie before. The healthcare exchange experience of the Affordable Care Act was a similar choice. States were given the option of defaulting to the federal exchange or creating their own. And the 16 or so states that decided to go on their own, in many cases, didn't have a very good experience. So I think there's a real a risk question that the governor has to decide in terms of who bears that responsibility. And that's only operational risk. There's the financial risk, too. It has to work from a cost perspective. There has to be enough interest in it. There have to be enough local agencies that contract for the service. And that's going to be on the state's shoulders as well. So those are some of the considerations I would think that a governor and his or her staff would want to think about as we go through the next few months.
It's an interesting perspective and analogy to the healthcare choices that were presented to the respective governors across the country. I'll tell you, there are some parties across the country who are positing the notion that the opt-out scenario could provide some similar benefits to general funds in some states and things along those nature. We have worked closely with FirstNet to try to run down some of those potential options. But do you care to talk a little bit about if a state were to opt out, is the money really statutorily driven towards maintenance of the network, or is it available to them to bring into their fund?
First and foremost, it's the former. The law says very clearly that all the revenues must be used to reinvest in the network. And that, I think, is perhaps a misconception on the part of some folks around the country. But the statute is clear, and that's not some idea that the FirstNet board came up with. That's what Congress had in mind. And I think that's understandable, because the congressional goal is to have a nationwide interoperable network. They wanted to defer to governors in terms of making this decision on building out the local network, but they want to make sure that it's interoperable and everybody can talk and communicate with everybody else. So I think everybody needs to understand how the revenue flow works and make sure that they don't make a decision based on a false assumption.
Thanks, Governor. I think it's important to hit on those risk factors, some of which we look at, all of which actually we look at here in New Jersey, both generally from a homeland security perspective, but specifically as an early builder, we're looking at some of the risks associated with keeping those capabilities that we've been fortunate enough to obtain and build out over the last couple of years in partnership with FirstNet. Along those lines, are there any similar risks that you see that an opt-out state would have, not just in the short term, but potentially in perpetuity?
Well, you make a great point, Eric, about the fact that we're designing a network that we anticipate will last forever, and where we're looking at the 25-year contract period initially. It's hard to know what the future holds in terms of technology. We couldn't have imagined a quarter century ago the kinds of capabilities we have today, and the pace of change is only accelerating. We already know that we're going to have 5G, the Internet of Things, mission-critical push-to-talk that will be important to public safety. The law requires very specifically that the reinvestment of the revenues from customers on the FirstNet network must be reinvested to maintain the network over the long haul, to be sure that it is reinvested to allow it to evolve with technology and continue to innovate over time. So that's another important consideration, I think, that states will have to think about as they decide during the next few months whether to opt in or not.
And as you articulate those differentiators, it takes me back again, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there are a lot of aspects that are bringing in not new technologies, but aspects that are not similar to your standard commercial network. And so shifting back over across to the folks that may be considering opting in, are there more advantages that you can articulate to say, hey, this isn't your, as you mentioned, technology is constantly evolving, and what we know today and yesterday will not be tomorrow's capabilities. And so what many see is today's commercial wireless capabilities, there's some differentiators there that FirstNet and AT&T can bring to the table. Is there more aspects or more details that you can expand on what capabilities will be available?
A couple come to mind, Eric. First of all, the security of the network. We need to be sure that the network we establish and deploy is secure, so that sensitive information can be transmitted without fear of it falling into the wrong hands or being compromised in any way. And I suppose in the 21st century, nothing is completely certain, but we believe that the network we're deploying with AT&T's assistance is going to provide much greater security, and we've established an infrastructure to ensure that. And secondly, I think it's important to think about devices and how they evolve over time. We talked about reinvestment in the network generally, but it's important that public safety professionals have the newest equipment as time goes on, the most modern and flexible accessories that are available in the marketplace, because we want those who are responsible for the lives and safety and health of our friends and neighbors and relatives to have only the best. So this is not just a one-time investment of putting up some towers, deploying a network, and then going home and forgetting about it. This is a constant reinvestment over the next quarter century and presumably beyond. And that's why the financial commitment that states consider making is so important, as well as the ongoing responsibility of making sure that the system maintains the highest standards that FirstNet will establish year after year.
Well, I can say we're excited for the capability, this next step. We're very excited for the plan to finally be delivered. We know that's coming soon, and I'm sure there's details you have that you can't share at this time. So I'll ask generally, is there anything else you would want to say about the details of the plan or the effort, without, of course, divulging too much, but to leave our audience with as we come to the conclusion of this podcast?
Well, I think we've had a good, thorough discussion on what FirstNet is, how it came to be, where we are in the process, and what we can look forward to, as well as the advantages to states in choosing to allow FirstNet to deploy the local network in each state and territory. I think I would urge all of those in the governmental and public safety community to keep their eye on the prize, to realize that in anything this comprehensive, there are always going to be a lot of details over which we could debate and perhaps even quibble. But in the end, this is about public safety. It's about ensuring that a network is available to those who protect us day in and day out, those who in whose care we entrust ourselves and our families and our neighbors and our property. And this is what Congress wants to accomplish as this final recommendation of the 9/11 Commission. So let's make sure we all focus on the bigger picture, on ensuring that we get this network up and running as quickly as we possibly can. And any specific issues that need to be worked out in an individual state plan, let's have those discussions, resolve them, and move on so that in the not-too-distant future, we can say that the First Responder Network is up and running and available to the people of the United States.
Thank you, sir. And I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, knowing Vermont's reputation, do you have a recommendation for maple syrup? And do you prefer downhill skiing or cross-country skiing?
On the first point, we are the largest maple syrup producer in America by far. The grading system of maple syrup was changed recently to conform to an international standard. We used to have letter grades A, B, C, and D, but now it's fine and extra fine, dark amber, medium amber, that sort of thing. This is a long answer to your question, Eric, but I like darker syrup. It's interesting. Lighter syrup is generally deemed to be of a higher quality, but I like a more robust flavor and taste, and so I'm a darker syrup kind of guy. On skiing, I'm not much of a skier. Tried it a little. I even tried snowboarding once. That wasn't too pretty a picture. So actually, I find myself skiing mostly on water.
Avoiding the snow, I assume.
But we're glad to be the third, usually, biggest ski state in America, behind Colorado and California. Sometimes Utah beats us, but more years than not, we're number three. It's a great place to visit, to enjoy, to vacation every season of the year. And we hope that a lot of folks from New Jersey will continue to come, because I know a lot of them do now.
Well, thank you again, Governor. We're very appreciative that you've visited us here at the Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. We hope you've enjoyed your visit to the state of New Jersey, and we thank you again for your time.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njhomelandsecurity.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.